This story is simply called Pete. You've probably gathered by now that my brother Pete was a big influence in my life. To this day, he remains an influence. His soft voice and always calm demeanor are gifts that he's been given, and he knows how to use them. There was, however, a time when we were just kids, and naughty ones at that. So let me tell you the story of Pete. Other than his ability to tame and care for all kinds of animals, snakes, legavans, a cantankerous crow and a few scruffy dogs, Pete had a wild side. One thing that he loved to do was steal my mother's car when she was asleep. My mum's story will be told, but for now let's just say she drank a bit and would pass out, especially when my dad was away on business. This was a perfect time to steal her car. Mum was forgetful and always lost her car keys, so my dad had a button installed so that all she had to do was press the button and the car would start. Her car was an old Opel and it was a manual drive. Pete would push her down the driveway, let the car run down the hill, and start the car when it was far enough away from the house so that no one could hear it. Here is where I came in. Quite often, in fact more often than not, the car would go off the tarred driveway and onto the grass verge and get stuck. Pete would wake me and make me help him push the car, but he always rewarded me by letting me come driving with him. Our neighborhood was quiet and we would drive around, Pete barely able to see over the steering wheel. He must have been 14 or maybe 15. The driving age in South Africa was 18. Incidentally, the same age as you could legally drink. Smart politicians, huh? We took the car most nights and never got caught. Then one time Pete made the mistake of stealing my dad's car. Dad was home and asleep. He drove a big old Valiant. I'm guessing that it was made out of steel. Pete managed to get it halfway down the drive, and then it went onto the grass. He woke me up to help him, but the two of us could not move the car. So we woke my brother Tuff, who didn't know about the car stealing that had been going on. He was half asleep, but he knew what to do, and the three of us got the car back onto the tar and out the gate. Then we took her for a drive. Now, the Valiant didn't have bucket seats. The front seat was just a bench, and it was covered in plastic, I guess to preserve the upholstery of the car. Pete, Tuff and I were cruising around the neighborhood, and we were heading back to the house when Pete decided that he wanted to see how fast the car could go. At that time, they were building a ring road around our town. It was a big job and still under construction. The entrance to the on-ramp was closed by a few 44-gallon drums. Pete told me to get out of the car and move the drums. I was probably 9 at the time, maybe 10. I knew that it was a really bad idea, but I did what I was told. Pete ordered and I followed. Moved the drums and got back into the car. We drove down the on-ramp and onto the highway. The road was recently tarred and there were still construction vehicles parked on the side of the road. We drove kind of slowly at first. Now picture this. Pete could barely see above the dashboard. Tuff couldn't see above the dashboard, and I definitely couldn't see anything. Because it was an unusually warm summer evening, we would sweat and then start to slip on the plastic seat cover. We thought that it was funny when he went around the corner and we all slid into each other, stacking up like a bunch of pancakes against the door. Drove for about a mile and then turned around, and that was when Pete gunned it. Now, for a speedometer on the Valiant, there's a red line that snakes out, showing the numbers of how fast you were going. I was watching the red snake, and it was starting to hit some high numbers. "I remember this today like it was yesterday," Pete said. "Shit, we're going 90. It doesn't really feel that fast, does it?" That was 90 miles an hour, not 90 kilometers an hour. South Africa had not yet changed to the metric system. The Valiant was gliding along and Pete had his foot flat on the accelerator. We didn't die that night. There must have been some guardian angels looking over us. We returned Dad's car. He never found out until many years later. When my dad was older and we had all survived into adulthood, he loved to hear the stories. He said that he had no idea that we had taken his car. He knew about the one incident when my grandmother, his mother, came for a visit. She would pull up in a Morris Minor, and as soon as she went into the house, we would jump in the car and take off. This was more fun because it was in the middle of the day and there were other cars on the road. One day we stole Granny's car, and when we got back to the house, she was standing there by the gate, arms folded, fuming. She'd only come by to drop something off for my mum and not to have tea. And when she came back out, her car was gone. 10 minutes later, me, Pete and Tuff pulled up. Dad knew about that incident. We used to go to the mountains for some of our holidays. The Drakensberg Mountains are just stunningly beautiful and are a wonderful place to hike. We were let free to go wherever we wanted to. There were paths and we had some old crude maps, but generally we had an idea where we were and how to get back to the camp in the evening. One day Pete spotted a nest and wanted to take a closer look. There was just the two of us. We found a path that would take us above the nest where we could look in. So we crept along the path, which suddenly got narrow, and suddenly there was a sheer drop of around 300 feet. We had both been so intent on trying to see what was in the nest that we didn't notice that we were in deep trouble. My legs turned to jelly. I was so scared I couldn't move. Pete had been leading and I was behind. In order to get back, I had to lead, but there was absolutely no way. Finally, Pete cajoled and threatened me, and inch by inch, we made it back to the safer part of the trail. We were so filled with adrenaline, I can still remember the high. It was all good fun until the one day we decided to go straight up. From the bottom of the cliff, it didn't look that high. There was no reason to climb it, except that it was there. So we started to climb. No ropes or anything. I didn't get very far. I clearly remember the day before when we were stuck on the ledge. So I went down and sat at the base of the cliff watching Pete climb. He was almost at the top but couldn't make it. He yelled at me to try and get above him so that I could guide him. I had remembered a path back along the track that looked like it might lead to some place above to where Pete was. And indeed it did. I found myself on a ledge and called for Pete, and it turned out that he was just below me. Now here's where the stupidity came in. Pete asked me if there's any kind of a ledge that he could hold on to. I told him that about 6 inches above where he was, that there was a small ledge, probably around 2 inches wide. I told Pete about the ledge, and without hesitating, he said, "I'm going to jump for it," and he did. He had been standing on a small ledge, but he managed to grab onto the ledge just below where I was. But the problem was he couldn't pull himself up, and he couldn't go back down to the ledge we had just been standing. Usually you can swing your legs under and use them to pull yourself up, but he was plastered against the rock face. I could see the tips of his fingers starting to turn white. Pete knew that he was in trouble and yelled at me to take my shirt off so that he could grab onto it and I could pull him up. I took my shirt off, and when I looked back down again, Pete was gone. I heard him hit the ground and I screamed. To this day I wonder what would have happened if he had grabbed my shirt. For sure, I would have gone over the ledge with him. I found Pete at the base of the cliff. He couldn't move. He told me to run and get our dad. I ran a mile or so back to the camp and found my father sipping a whiskey in his easy chair. He managed to get the camp ranger and some help and a stretcher, and we made our way back to the cliff. It was dark by the time that we found Pete. He had not moved. He told our dad that he thought his back was broken. And it was. His spine had snapped. Here is where the real damage was done. In these days there would have been a helicopter and a trained medevac team that would have come with a vacuum stretcher and immobilized him. Instead they did that, you know, you get his arms and I'll get his feet and we'll carry him onto the stretcher kind of thing. Of course his back bent even more. That's where I think the real damage was done. Pete spent over a year in hospital. At first he was paralyzed from the waist down, but with some multiple surgeries, they found that some of the nerves to his right leg were only pinched. They were able to release the nerves, and over a few months they healed so that he could use the thigh muscle on his right leg. Below the knee was kaput, and his whole left leg was paralyzed. For a year he lived in a wheelchair and walked with calipers strapped to both legs and spent endless hours in physical therapy. He was finally able to ditch the calipers and walk with crutches, and to this day, 57 years later, he is still only able to get around in crutches. Pete was just shy of his 16th birthday when he fell. I was 10. Many years later, in fact the day that my dad was being cremated, Pete, my sister Sue, Tuff and my younger brother Rob decided to go for a walk in the mountains. It was just too hard to think about Dad being cremated. He never returned to that place in the Drakensberg, but we, for whatever reason, decided that we wanted to go back there. We were walking along a path, not really sure where we were going, all of us in a bit of a daze, when I said, "I know where we are." I said, "Just around this corner is the cliff." And sure enough, there it was. It was a bit overgrown and was only about 30 feet high. The base of the cliff was on a slope, and I've no idea if that made the fall worse or not. We closed the loop on that chapter. I'll never go back there again. Pete, in his own way, thinks that the fall was a blessing. He had planned to go into the bush right after high school, but being trapped in a wheelchair, he was stuck with the only option being to go to university, and he graduated 6 years later with a degree in wildlife management. There are a ton of post-accident stories worth telling. Let's just start with the one night that we were sitting around a fire when Pete said, "Does anyone smell burning?" What had happened was that an ember from the fire had landed on Pete's left leg. Because he had no feeling, he didn't notice that the ember was cooking his leg. What he had smelt was his flesh burning. Pete thought it was funny, even though his jeans were ruined. Pete was paralyzed from the waist down, well, most of it. But he could still use his hands, so he got a scooter that he could use to get around on. One day, he was driving down a busy road. I was on the back when I noticed that his leg had fallen off the scooter deck and was dragging on the ground. Of course, Pete couldn't feel it. I gestured to him about his leg, and when he turned around, he didn't notice a car pull in front of us. Then we T-boned it. Pete went into the side pretty hard. I went over the top. The person driving the car hit the gas and never stopped. As part of the thesis to get his master's degree, Pete had to prove that a certain area of a game park in the northeastern part of South Africa was getting overgrazed by the hippopotamus and not the deer, or buck as we call them in South Africa. When you fence in any area, no matter how big the space is, you disrupt the ecosystem, and for years they had been culling deer to keep the numbers down in an effort to stop overgrazing. Pete was convinced that it was the hippopotamuses that were causing the trouble and not the deer. Hippos are very territorial grazers. Pete's theory was proven right. The hippos were the problem, but not all hippos. Just the ones that were grazing in the area that was being overgrazed. So he came up with a plan. He and I would camp out either side of the path that the hippos used when they came out of the lakes at night to go and graze on the floodplain. Turned out that we went to sleep and never woke up. In the morning we figured that at least a dozen hippos had walked between us to go out grazing for the night and then walked back, and we never woke up. The next night Pete took his dog with us. And sure enough, she woke us up, and we followed the hippos for a few hours until we, or Pete rather, decided which hippo was causing the overgrazing problem. We shot it with a paint gun and then went to bed. The next morning we went down to the lake, the Vlei as it's called in South Africa, and we saw the one hippo with blue paint on his back. So Pete had his guards go out in their canoe and shoot it. The hippo sank like a stone, but after an hour or so it popped right back to the surface like a cork. I guess that the gastric juices had kicked in. The guides rode out, tied a rope around its ankle, and the other went to a Land Rover and pulled the hippo ashore. While they were doing that, some of the other guides were making a fire. As soon as the hippo was on dry land, they cut it open and went straight for the heart. In no time it was on the fire cooking. I ate some and it was good. What I didn't do, however, was dip it in the blood that was gushing out of the hippo. The guides loved it, and we feasted on all the organs. Of course, the hippo was cut up and the meat distributed amongst the guides, and Pete and I had hippo steaks for a long time. The Afrikaans word for hippo is sekoi, which translates to sea cow. Yes, the meat tasted like a nice, big, lean steak. The overgrazing problem was solved, and for the first time in Africa, culling hippos became a thing. One time I was visiting Pete in Botswana. He had married Daisy, a Tswana woman. She already had three children from a previous marriage, so Pete had an instant family. I was in Africa with my daughter Tori, and we were on an extended trip through Botswana and Zimbabwe. One night we camped out by a lake. It was an area called Maremi, which was on the Okavango Delta. Pete and Daisy were in one tent, me and Tori in the other, and my nephew Justin and his friend Mikey in their own tent. Quick side story. Many years later, Mikey and his friends were out on a hunting trip when a gun went off and hit him. He's been in a wheelchair since. but I digress. Tori woke me sometime in the night. The tent flap was wide open, and there, less than 10 feet from us, a herd of elephants walked right through our camp. It was incredible how quiet they were. It was a totally magical experience, and even though Tori was just 7 at the time, she remembers it well. As a teenager, she used to write essays that were titled, "This story is based on my travels in Africa with my dad." Her teachers never believed her. Now that's what I call good parenting. So the next morning we told Pete about the elephants, and he said that he also had a story. About a month earlier, he and Daisy had been camping in the exact same spot. Pete woke up in the early morning and felt a warm body up against him, and thought that it was Daisy, until he realized that Daisy was on the other side of him. Then he saw a big tongue licking the dew off the tent, and realized that his bed companion was a lion. He woke Daisy, and they lay there completely still until the sun came up and it got warm and the pride left. It looked like there had been around a half dozen lions right next to their tent all night. I was quite happy that he hadn't told me the story before we went to bed. I had heard lion roaring in the night, and the sound made the hairs on the back of my neck stand straight up. I once visited Pete with some friends who I was sailing around the world with. I was there with my wife, Erin. We had seen 4 of the big 5, as they call them in Africa. We had seen the lion, leopard, elephant and Cape buffalo, but we hadn't seen any black rhino. Now these are dangerous animals. Their eyesight is bad and they generally have a really bad attitude. Unlike most animals, when they sense humans are near, they just run away. Not the black rhino. They come over and investigate, and if they don't like what they see, they basically beat the shit out of it. We were on foot when we saw 2 black rhinos across a small, empty plain. We wanted to get closer. We were downwind, so Pete figured that it was safe to go closer. And we were halfway across the plain, about 50 or 60 yards from the rhino, when Pete picked up some soft sand and let it run through his fingers. The wind had changed direction, and now it was blowing directly towards the rhino. We could see that the rhino had picked up our scent. We were suddenly in a bit of trouble. There's an old saying that the bushmen have that goes, "When you see a black rhino, you first look for a tree to climb, then you look at the rhino." The only tree near us was an acacia tree, and they have very long and very sharp thorns. Pete ordered everyone up the tree. My friends were incredulous. There was no way that they were going to climb that tree. That was until one of the rhinos started to move toward us. Then they all started climbing. It was just Pete and me left. The rhino was still coming toward us. Pete took one of his crutches and threw it to distract the rhino, who couldn't see us but was sure that there was something there to investigate. It came closer. Pete threw his other crutch and the rhino looked in that direction and then back towards where we were standing. Pete told me to make a run for it, and I ran. The rhino charged. Pete obviously couldn't go anywhere, so he just stood. The rhino came to about 6 feet from him, still not able to see anything. He snorted, pawed the ground, and then ran away. I picked up the crutches. The others climbed down from the tree, all covered in blood. It had taken them about 10 seconds to get up the tree. It took them an hour to get down. One last story. I wasn't there for this one. My dad, my brother Rob, and Pete were in the bush, and a similar thing happened. They didn't see the rhino at first, but they did see a baby rhino. And Pete knew that where there was a baby rhino, there would be a mother rhino close by. Sure enough, the rhino came for them. They ran and climbed the tree, Pete as well. My dad and Rob swear that Pete's crutches were about 20 feet from the tree. Somehow he had run, paralyzed leg and all. There are many stories that I can tell you about Pete and the troubles that we got into. In my book of short stories, More Twisted Tales, there's a fictionalized story about the lion sleeping up against the tent. It's called Good Women and Priests. For more about Pete, there's a chapter in my book, Two Bricks and a Tiki High. The chapter is, of course, named Pete. Pete and Daisy still live in the Okavango Delta in Botswana. Pete is the leading expert of the birds of Botswana. He's written many books on the subject. All 3 of their children are in the safari business. The eldest, Tuto, has won numerous awards as the best game guide in Southern Africa. Pete is back in a wheelchair and stays close to home as his health has not been that great recently. I so want to go back and visit him and spend some time in a place where I'm the most comfortable, the African bush. Well, I hope you enjoy the story, and as always, thank you for listening.